Tactopia. Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, med støtte fra Industriens Fond, Messecenter Herning, Index Award og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. I forrige udgave af Tektopia, der kom jeg sådan lidt, måske ikke så elegant, til at kalde alle jer lyttere for kødsække fulde af data. Fordi når man bruger datasamfundet, så er man jo bare data, som kan analyseres og misbruges eller bruges til det gode af offentlige myndigheder, spiontjenester eller virksomheder eller måske hackere, der vil sælge dig ting og overvåge dig eller manipulere med dig politisk eller måske bare holde styr på din motion og dit helbred for dig. Den amerikanske whistleblower Edward Snowden, han udtrykte det for nylig på den her måde på festivalen Web Summit i Lissabon.
These people are engaged in abuse, particularly when you look at a Google, an Amazon, a Facebook. But their business model is abuse. And yet every bit of it, they argue, is legal. And whether we're talking about Facebook or the NSA, that is the problem. That's the real problem. We have legalized the abuse of the person, through the personal. We have entrenched a system that makes the population vulnerable for the benefit of the privileged.
Som du kan høre, så er Edward Snowden mere end bekymret for det datasamfund, vi alle sammen lever i lige nu. Og når man lever i det her datasamfund, ja, så skal man nok til at tænke over, hvad det egentlig er, der foregår med de der data, og hvordan man faktisk er gået hen og blevet sådan gennemsigtig, så alle kan se, hvad det egentlig er, man tror, tænker og går rundt og foretager sig. Og til at hjælpe os med at finde ud af det, så har vi i dag et interview med Carly Kent fra Ada Lovelace Institute i London, der er sådan en uafhængig forsknings- og tænketank, som kigger kritisk på den indflydelse, data og kunstig intelligens har på mennesker og samfund. Og så skal vi hilse på Googles leder af afdelingen for udvikling af kunstig intelligens i Zürich, der vil fortælle os om Googles nye principper for ansvarlig brug af kunstig intelligens. Men lad os først lige høre, hvad Carly Kent fra Ada Lovelace Institute hun siger om forholdet mellem data og kunstig intelligens og store virksomheder og samfundet generelt.
Ada Lovelace Institute is an independent research institute and think tank with a remit to ensure that AI and data work for people and society. So essentially we're about representing the public interest in conversations about new technologies and how they're changing society.
And it's based somewhere in the UK?
It's based in London. We're funded by a philanthropic foundation called the Nuffield Foundation based in London.
Why is it named after Ada Lovelace and when you explain this, you might also explain who she was.
Of course. So Ada Lovelace was is widely regarded to have been the first ever computer programmer. In the 1840s, she wrote essentially an algorithm for a conceptual computer that had been designed by a mathematician called Charles Babbage. And she looked at Babbage's plans for this thing he called the analytical engine, and she wrote essentially a computer program for it. The reason why we called the Institute after her is not only because she was a pioneering woman in the field of computing at a time in which computing was a futuristic science, but because she understood for arguably the first time how much potential there was in technology to do all sorts of things that were outside the realm of contemplation at the time. So Babbage designed his machine for purely computing mathematical equations, but Lovelace looked at that machine and said, this could one day be used to write music or compose novels. She really understood that computers could be tasked to any range of human endeavor. So that's the reason that we wanted to call the Institute after her, because she said computers could be put to any one of the purposes of mankind, and we think that that's what technology should be. That's a starting point for technology, that it can be used for any range of different things, and it should be used to improve societies.
Why is this institute a private organization? I mean, why is not associated with the government, for instance?
At this stage, we're hoping to remain free from funding and affiliation with private and public sector entities, we think that governments are makers of technology, are deployers of technology, just like the private sector. And we think that there's a role for an independent organization that doesn't have any ties to any of those interests and can purely represent the public interest. And there are many other organizations funded by government and by the private sector, but our kind of unique selling point, as it were, is to remain independent of all of those entities.
But seen from a public interest point of view, what should you, I mean, what are you dealing with? What kind of issues do you look at? What are you worried about and so on?
So we're looking at a range of different things, to give you some examples. As AI develops, we all know that it is dependent on data and large data sets in order to fuel task machine learning capabilities. Where does that data come from, and what rules govern its acquisition and its use? Are people's privacy protected? Is their data properly used and acquired? So there's a kind of data governance question, I think, which underpins this technological revolution that we're interested in looking at from the perspective of the public and saying, how do we ensure that people's privacy is protected, but also we get enough data to build the technologies we want to build, and what are the trade-offs in doing that, and what protections need to exist? So that's one issue. Another issue, the more kind of tangible technology that we're looking at, is facial recognition technology and trying to understand, A, what are public appetites for facial recognition technology? Do people want this in their cities, in their public transport systems, in their homes? And if so, how should it be governed and restricted and limited by potentially state regulation? How should companies build that technology so that it's as private as possible? And try and, I suppose, connect the opinions of the public with the technologies, companies themselves, and with the government who are going to regulate the technology.
You mentioned on stage about an hour ago that you're more interested in what kind of society we want to build than in what tech we want to build.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of people approaching this from the perspective of just looking at the technology itself and how do we improve it, how do we put in protections. But as I think a different way of looking at it, which gives really reflects more how fundamentally it's going to change our society, is to say, what is this piece of technology going to do to our relationships with our community, with our governments, with each other, and start from the perspective of what kind of society do we want to build. So what are the values that we think are important? Are those values convenience and utility, or are those values solidarity and community and diversity? We think it's the latter. We think that kind of the arc of human progress shows that people value those types of social norms, and so we think technology should reinforce those social norms.
If you look at the world as it is today, 2019, dominated by mainly five major American companies, how do you think it's going?
I think the concentration of power in the hands of a few companies is one of the most fundamentally problematic results of the failure of policy and regulation to keep up with how technology has advanced. I think lawmakers, policymakers, politicians, nobody had enough foresight to see how technology would race ahead without there being any restrictions on it. And as a result, we've seen, as you've rightly said, these huge monopolies emerge that have made the most out of big lacuna in regulation and legislation. And rolling that back is very difficult at this stage. I think that's one of the lessons we learned. I think if you think also about how those major technology companies not only have kind of dominance of platforms and of networks, but also have dominance of data. They have the most data, and the data is the launch pad from which the AI revolution is going to fly. So by concentrating that data in the hands of a few, we're only ensuring that that AI revolution will also be concentrated in the hands of a few. So I think one of the biggest challenges for us is to think about how can we liberate that data from those five or so major companies. I think probably there are more in China and elsewhere that we should also be thinking about. How do we make sure that there can be competitors in this revolution? How do we ensure that smaller startups have access to the same data that Google and Facebook have access to so that they can build AI technologies as well? in terms of what the solution to that is, I'm a lawyer, so I tend to think first about how regulation can change things. But I think that companies operating in the public interest can also change that power dimension as well. I mean, there's nothing to say that Google, Facebook and others couldn't choose to break apart, couldn't choose to kind of devolve some of their power. And the question is, how do we get them to be in that place? We've seen recently how tech workers themselves have tried to influence their employers to act more in the public interest, and I think there's some potential for continuing to push on that lever. I think there's also the lever of kind of public, you know, public demand and public attention to these issues. Since Cambridge Analytica, we've seen kind of more and more public pressure for them to act better. Whether that or not that translates into better corporate behaviour, I'm not totally convinced at this stage.
There's also been a lot of discussion about this sort of AI arms race between the United States and China, and that China might be winning. So do you see a third way for Europe, and also to the extent that you are still part of Europe as a country, but do you see a third way?
I do see a third way. I think the European Union is trying to forge that third way through its focus on ethical approaches to AI. The UK actually has also ambitions to be a leader in that respect. They've established a government centre for data ethics and innovation as well. Making their claim is to make the UK the kind of best and safest place to develop technology. I hope, you know, I very much hope that that third way is one which says it's not about competition for numbers or size or profits. It's about competition for the best product, which create the most public value. You know, I think the EU is doing the right thing in terms of stimulating that. Whether or not it's enough to counter the arms race between the US and China, I'm not entirely convinced, I have to say. And that's why I think we can't just forget those two jurisdictions and focus on Europe. I think we need to also think about how we influence Chinese and American companies as well. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier about thinking about different ways in which you impact this technology system. Is it through regulation? Is it through policy? Is it through public, you know, people voting with their feet, that type of thing? And I think there are a range of different ways that you can think about it. And at the Ada Lovelace Institute, that's one of the challenges that we've set ourselves, to think about how do you move these technology companies away from their current trajectory.
Carly Kent, hun efterlyste til sidst, at tech-giganterne og tech-selskaberne skal blive mere ansvarlige i deres omgang med vores data og deres brug af kunstig intelligens. Og på en eller anden måde så virker det som om, at Google har lyttet. De er i hvert fald som den første store tech-virksomhed gået ud og sagt, jamen vi laver simpelthen et regelsæt for, hvordan vi bruger kunstig intelligens ansvarligt. Og måske skulle jeg lige læse op, hvad der står i det regelsæt, sådan ganske kort. De har et mål for kunstig intelligens-applikationer, som de siger, og Google siger, at vi vil vurdere kunstig intelligens-applikationer på baggrund af følgende mål. Og så siger de, at vi mener, at kunstig intelligens bør 1. være socialt gavnlig, 2. undgå at skabe eller forstærke urimelig bias, og det handler her blandt andet om kønspolitik. Kunstig intelligens skal bygges og testes for sikkerhed. 4. Den skal være ansvarlig over for mennesker. 5. Der skal indarbejdes principper for privatlivsdesign i den kunstige intelligens. Punkt nummer 6. Den kunstige intelligens skal overholde høje standarder for videnskabelig ekspertise. Den kunstige intelligens skal gøres tilgængelig for anvendelser, der er i overensstemmelse med disse principper. Det vil sige, at man må ikke bruge den til andre ting. Og derfor så har de også fundet det nødvendigt at tilføje, hvad de ikke vil designe eller implementere kunstig intelligens til. Og der siger de, teknologier, der forårsager eller sandsynligvis forårsager generel skade. Hvis der er en væsentlig risiko for, at de kan forårsage skade, så fortsætter man kun, hvis man mener, at fordelene væsentligt opvejer risici og vil indeholde passende sikkerhedsbegrænsninger. De vil ikke beskæftige sig med våben eller andre teknologier, hvis hovedformål eller implementering er at forårsage eller direkte gøre skade på mennesker. Og her der tænker de jo nok også på, at de var involveret i et projekt med amerikanske militær, hvor de Google-ansatte blev voldsomt vrede, og flere af dem faktisk sagde op i protest. Så det er en konsekvens af det. Og så vil de heller ikke satse på teknologier, der indsamler eller bruger information til overvågning, der krænker internationalt accepterede normer. Og teknologier, hvis formål er i modstrid med almindelige anerkendte principper i international ret og menneskerettigheder, de er også no-go i Googles kunstig intelligensprincipper. Og så tilføjer de til sidst, at det her er jo et felt, som udvikler sig, så derfor så kommer de her regler også til at forandre sig med tiden, der kan komme flere ting på, som man ikke vil gøre, eller som man skal gøre. En af mændene bag det her regelsæt, han hedder Olivier Bousquet, og ham mødte jeg i Zürich, hvor Googles udviklingsafdeling for kunstig intelligens ligger, som han jo også er leder af, og han fortalte mig om Googles nye principper for brug af kunstig intelligens, fordi, som I kan høre, så er det faktisk gået op for dem, der føler et ansvar med, når man er sådan en dominerende kommerciel virksomhed i datasamfundet.
My name is Olivier Bousquet, and I'm based in Zurich, working for Google as a researcher, leading a team of people doing research in artificial intelligence.
This morning you presented the AI principles of Google. Could you tell me a bit more about how these principles came about? Was it because you had a push from the media or from the users? Or why did you find it necessary to make a list of principles?
I guess it's a combination of things factors. Really, because as we, you know, started to explore applications of artificial intelligence as a new technology that was emerging, like a couple of, let's say, 5-6 years ago, we started, of course, experimenting with this technology and then thinking how we could apply it to a number of our products. As we did that, we realized that, and not just us, also the broader community or the broader scientific community realized that while this technology was encountering lots and lots of positive application, there were also risks associated to it, and maybe, you know, things like bias or privacy or things that were potential risk of developing this technology and applying it to specific areas. So that was the broader context. That led to a conversation that happened both outside, of course, in the media, but also in scientific circles, and also internally at Google with our employees and people working on this technology. And this whole conversation led to the realization that we have to be very mindful and responsible as we develop these applications. And we have to make sure that we think upfront at the time where we start thinking about the algorithms, about the potential misuse of this technology or possible negative side effects of deploying these algorithms, and that's why we created those principles, to make sure that some of the this attention to those aspects was already there in Google. We already had processes, say for privacy, for example. For a long time, we had very strict processes to ensure privacy of user data. But with the advent of AI and the new applications of AI, we felt that it was important to clarify those and to publish explicit principles, not just internally, but also to the world, because we feel that this conversation should not stop at Google and should involve also external stakeholders.
You mentioned the algorithms. When you start a new project, a new product, what comes first, the principles or the technology? I mean, how does it start?
Well, it's usually a bit of a combination, right? Like, we may think of one new way of applying the technology to a particular user need or a particular problem. Say, for example, let me take a concrete example. We have people that are working on speech synthesis, it's called. So speech synthesis means you have some text and you want to produce sound that correspond to the text, like as someone reading that text, right? In this particular case, our researchers thought, oh, well, maybe we can develop speech synthesis technology that is personalized, that can speak in your own voice. One particular idea of why this could be useful and interesting is in relation to our project Euphonia, which is a project that is aimed at understanding people that have speech disabilities, like they have trouble expressing themselves or making themselves understood. The idea was, if we have some system that can recognize and understand their speech and translate it into a more intelligible sound, then they would be able to communicate much better with their friends, family, and so on. So, you know, this is an example of an idea that could have come, and researchers said, well, for that we would need to develop specific technology, or adapt existing technology, or make it a little bit better in that axis, because, for example, it would require to be able to perform very good speech synthesis with very little data, because there would be only a small amount of data available for any particular user, say. So in this case, you know, this comes as an idea. There is a discussion. First of all, you know, even before doing any work, we might discuss, oh, okay, well, this might also represent a certain amount of risk, because if we have technology that allows to fake anyone's voice, obviously that could be used in, you know, detrimental ways. So already at this stage, there is a conversation. And then we may decide to pull off and not go into this direction because we think the risk is not worth it, or, you know, it's too big. Or we may move to the next stage, and now we know that there is a risk, but we are thinking about how to mitigate that risk, and maybe mitigating that risk in this case means making sure that the technology cannot be easily used for negative purpose, or putting safeguards into the system, or other approaches like this. And then as you know, the process goes along, we may decide at any point to stop, because we see that there is no way to provide the technology to get to the positive impact without inducing some negative impact, and then we step back.
Will these principles for AI prevent Google from participating in projects like Project Maven with the military in the future?
Yes, definitely. Definitely now it's very clearly stated in our principle that we will not apply AI technology to applications that may lead to harm. And that's very clearly why we kind of stopped that project, and we will not engage in such projects in the future.
Now, people like Elon Musk and others, they're very worried about artificial intelligence somewhere in the far future. Mm-hmm. I know that you have been working with machine learning and artificial intelligence for many, 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 many years, and you are educated in this field. So does anything about artificial intelligence keep you up at night and worry you?
Definitely. I mean, and, you know, it's in some sense embodied in our principles. I know well the risks of the of developing this technology. But maybe to your point about Elon Musk, I think, yes, in the far future, there could be other risks than the ones that we're seeing now. But we are more focused, more pragmatically, let's say, focused on the risks that are induced by the use of the current technology, which is really very limited in its ability to, you know, perform intelligent tasks. But this, even with this limited ability, it may have negative impact on the society, such as inducing bias or reinforcing inequalities. And these are the kind of things that we are more worried about at the moment, right? Like, as we deploy this technology, we want to make sure that it's used in a beneficial way. Extrapolations of what it could be doing in the future, that's certainly something that we have to think about, but which is not of immediate concern, I would say.
So what you're saying is that the sum of single-purpose artificial intelligence could be more dangerous, if you should use that word, than a possible future general artificial intelligence?
So I think we are very far from general artificial intelligence. Right now, what the technology allows is to perform certain very specific tasks very well, and occasionally even better than humans, like playing Go, or recognizing certain objects in images, or translating or understanding voice, translating languages, and so on. For some of these very specific tasks, the technology can, you know, at least be as good as humans, or sometimes better. But really, it only works on those specific tasks, and with, you know, training and data that is specific to that task. So it's very hard to imagine, even as a scientist, how we would go from there to something that would be very general and could handle any kind of task. That's indeed, you know, a challenging and motivating direction of research, but we are very, very far.
Jeg linker til Googles principper for ansvarlig kunstig intelligens og til Ada Lovelace Institute på tektopia.dk. Og der er faktisk mere Tektopia om datasamfundet i Tektopia Radio 4, vores udsendelse på Radio 4, der også er ude som podcast. Lad os lige tage en bid fra den. Ugens podcast fra Radio 4, Tektopia på Radio 4, der skal vi snakke om søvn og om data. Vi skal snakke om en finsk ring, en fingerring, som kan måle ens søvn. Jeg har to gæster. Jeg har Martin Kremmer, som er biohacker. Og Martin, du går selv rundt med den her ring. Hvad bruger du den til?
Den bruger jeg meget målrettet til at optimere min søvn på daglig basis.
Og så har jeg Birgitte Kornum, som er søvnforsker fra Københavns Universitet og forfatter til bogen Forstå din søvn. Hvad tænker du om sådan en ring, der kan måle søvn?
Jeg synes, det er en god idé at være lidt mere opmærksom på sin søvn og finde ud af, hvad der påvirker den.
Og i podcasten Tektopia på Radio 4, der kan du så høre mere om søvn og hvordan du måler din søvn og hvordan du får en bedre søvnrytme. Du kan finde links og podcastarkiv på tektopia.dk. Du kan skrive til mig på henrik@tektopia.dk. Du kan følge med på Twitter på @tektopia.dk. Og så kan du deltage i debatten i vores Facebook-gruppe Tektopia Backstage. På genhør. Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus med støtte fra Industriens Fond, Messecenter Herning, Index Award og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Tektopia.